our reading today is the Langston Hughes poem, Let America Be America Again. It was written in 1938 and is delivered this morning by LeTevin Ellis.
Let America be America again, by Langston Hughes. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plains, seeking the home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great strong land of love where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It was never America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, of power, of gain. Grab the land, of grab the goal, of grab the ways of satisfying the need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean. Hungry yet today despite the dream. Beaten yet today, oh, pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker, bartered through the years, yet I am the one who dreamt our basic dream. In the old world, while still the serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings. In every brick and stone, in every furrow turned, that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I am the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home, for I am the one who left the dark Ireland shores and Poland's plains and England's grassy lee, and torn from black Africa's strand, I came to build a homeland of the free. The free. Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on release today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay, for all those dreams we have dreamed, all those songs we have sung, all those hopes we have held, all those flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead. Oh, let America be America again. The land that has never has been yet and yet must be. The land where every man is free. The land that's mine, the poor man's, the Indians, Negroes, me, who made America. Whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The seal of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the wreck and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, the land, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain, all that stretch of these great green states, and make America again. Thank you.
And now it is my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker this morning, Kevin Jones, an actor who has enjoyed an award-winning career on the American stage for more than 30 years. He is the principal conjurer and co-creator of the August Wilson Red Door Project, a nonprofit that uses art as a catalyst, as you've already heard, to transform the racial ecology of Portland. Kevin also specializes in leadership development and helping organizations integrate diversity, equality, equity, and inclusion into their cultures and strategic initiatives. This year he has been especially busy, not only bringing Hands Up to several venues around Portland and now touring throughout the state, but having spent time in New York where the play was commissioned by the New Black Fest, located in Brooklyn. Most recently, Kevin has been directing the August Wilson autobiographical one-man show, How I Learned What I Learned, now playing to stunning reviews at the Portland Playhouse. And he has also directed six other plays in Portland, among them Blood Knot, Seven Guitars, A Lesson Before Dying, and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. So, without further ado, let us welcome Kevin Jones.
Thank you. Am I on? Hi. It's just really great to be here. I've been very excited to just be in this room. I find the church to be a very special place for me. I was raised in a church. And there's three things that I believe a church does. It provides a place to change, effective way to change. It also provides me with a sacred place to be in the world, and the most important thing it does is it offers a place for grace, and God knows we need grace. And as I watched the ceremony this morning and observed the ritual, you know, it's I think about how little ritual I actually experience in the world, other than the ritual I create for myself in my own life with my own family. But I'd like to, I would love it if we could find a way to do that more in our daily life and in our interactions with people who are different from us. So anyway, I don't want to do that too many times. That was loud. Selena, do you need this? Do you need this? Okay. Because I need room. So as Selena said, I am the co-founder of the August Wilson Red Door Project. I've been in Portland for about 12 years, and I thought it would be helpful for myself, if anyone else, to talk a little bit about how I got to do what I do here in Portland, where I came from. And I'm inspired by this play that Selena mentioned that's playing at Portland Playhouse, August Wilson's one-man show that he wrote. It's called How I Learned What I Learned. And that's a play where he goes back through his life from the time he was 20 years old as a poet, and through that he tells us a story of how he came to be who he was. And in so doing, you could see it in a way that you would never think. And I would encourage you to do the same thing, is to write a memoir or write a biography, because in doing that, everything that you are right now, how you show up in the world right now, today, will lay itself out in that story you tell about yourself. And so this is a way to help explain a little bit about Hands Up and a little bit about the August Wilson Red Door Project. Who here has heard of the August Wilson Red Door Project? I know Isabel. Isabel, hi. So there are people. Could you hold your hands up again, please? Oh, cool. cool. That is so cool. Okay, great. So that's a good start. So I just want to start tell you a little bit about me. So I grew up in a place where it was natural to see a vast landscape of black people. Blocks and blocks and miles of black people. Not just black Americans, but black Jamaicans, black Haitians, black Cubans, black Puerto Ricans. My church, my school, the public buildings, all were filled with black folks. Where there were black people from all walks of life, blue-collar workers, there were managers, teachers, doctors, dentists. Some of the police officers were even black. There were jazz musicians like Louis Armstrong, Milt Hinton, Bud Powell, Lester Young, Ella Fitzgerald, Arthur Prysock, Barbara McNair, all lived around the corner or within a few blocks from me. We kids used to play in Count Basie's pool, who lived next door to James Brown, whose maid we used to terrorize as we hopped over his fence to peek in while he practiced with his band. I got an opportunity to meet Malcolm X when I was a kid. I was standing outside a church similar to this, smoking cigarettes with my buddies. A band pulls up, and the guy says, "Hey, you kids want some bean pie?" I said, "Bean pie, what's that?" "Just get in the van, you'll find out." Back in the days, you could do that kind of thing. So we got in the van, we drove about two or three blocks, and he pulls up into a brownstone, he points down to the basement door, he says, "Go in that door, and you'll get your bean pie." So we walked in and we see a room similar to this, not quite as big, a linoleum floor. There was two sets of seats, an aisle down the middle, and there was a guy standing in the middle of the room. He got a dark suit on, light skin, freckles, beard, scary dude, angry man, talking about how the white man is going to put us all under. And I'm looking at him and I'm going, "Holy mackerel, who's this?" Now, I went to a Baptist Christian church. I'm a Martin Luther King guy back then, right? So he calls us up. He says, "You kids, come on up here. Where have you been?" He said, "You've been in a white man's church, haven't you?" I said, "No, our minister's black. Everybody in the church is black." "No, that's the white man's church. And I'm going to tell you something right now. You're going to go to hell if you keep paying attention to that. You're going to go to hell if you keep going and paying attention to that. You hear what I'm saying?" And we looked at him, and we just kind of all just shook our heads. You know, we were like 13, 14 years old. And with that, he said, "Now get on out of here and go back to your church and tell them what I said." And so we ran out the back door. I mean, ran out the back door, and we ran to our church. And I went in the church, and I sat down in the church, swore off cigarettes. I'm not smoking ever again. And I stayed in that church till I was 18 years old. Interesting thing that happened, though, a few days after that incident, Dan Rather was interviewing Malcolm X on TV, and I said, "Dad, I saw him." "You saw who?" "Him, that guy, Malcolm X." He said, "You saw him?" I said, "Yeah, he was at, we were at his church, he gave us some bean pie and everything, he was right around the corner from Amity Baptist." He said, "You stay away from that man, you understand me? Don't you ever get near him again. You understand me?" And he said, "He is a bad thing for the black movement right now. So you just stay away from him." And I have to say that stayed with me for till I was in my 30s. And it wasn't until I was 31 years old that I actually read Malcolm X's autobiography, where I realized that there's more to the story. There's a lot more to the story. So, I digress, when I get back to my little black community. My life as a youth was layered with an assumption and a self-confidence that being black and being American were synonymous. I didn't know that the community where I was raised in was the resting place for the settlement for Harlem's elite. And as they fled the crowded, crime-infested neighborhoods, they brought with them self-assuredness and hope for the future and money. And while white musicians scattered to the suburbs of Long Island, African-American jazz musicians thwarted by segregation clustered to the corners of Queens, New York, Anybody here from Queens? It's usually one or two people.
There you go.
And you're the right age, too. Queens, New York, and Corona. Corona was one place. Jamaica was the other. That's where I was from. And Louis Armstrong, he bought a two-story house where the composer Clarence Williams, you guys probably don't know who that is, and his wife, the singer Eva Taylor, moved with dreams of starting a black artist colony. The musicians who followed were amongst the first African Americans to move into these neighborhoods, helping to establish what would later become a mecca for the city's black middle class. I was raised in this world. It's important that I remind myself of that, living here in Portland. I took so much for granted. My mother was a registered nurse, and my dad, who left home when I was 9 but was always around even after he left, was a postal worker, a civil servant worker. And civil servant workers back then in the 50s and the 60s, you know, that was like a middle management job. At 16 years old, I worked as a counselor at a Black Panther youth summer camp program where we spent time all summer instilling a sense of pride and self-determination in the kids we worked with. All this while the backdrop of racial unrest loomed in the news and the Vietnam War was fracturing the country. Then drugs hit. Heroin. I'll never forget it. My best friend, my mentor, went downstairs in the basement. I used to live in a garden apartment. And I walked in to drop the, take the garbage off, and the man that I looked up to, the man that was, he was truly my mentor, was downstairs shooting up. And it scared the living dickens out of me. Not him, but that this thing, this whatever it was, this wave that was moving through our community was affecting someone that I had so much respect for and relied so much on. I began to notice that my race, as I moved out of Queens and out of that mecca, out of that black mecca, that my race, the skin color, was seen as everything from a threat to deviant to special, different, distinct, exotic, maybe diverse. And then came affirmative action. Anybody here remember affirmative action? With all its entitlements. And despite some of the opportunities and benefits of affirmative action in my life and in my world, things got ugly. Because with entitlement came resentments. Increased doubts from white America about capacity or talents of black Americans, and growing cultural dependency on handouts, and looking beyond one's immediate world, which is where I was able to get everything I needed. There was nothing I needed more. Everything I needed, I got from my community. And now I was being told that, you know what, your community can't take care of you anymore. You got to reach out. You need handouts. You need help. And so that's, what does that do? That creates a dependency. It created an enabling that rocked the very foundation of one's resourcefulness and selfhood. And as I grew up out into the world, I embraced music. I had been studying classical guitar since I was 13 years old. I know you can't believe it looking at me now, but I was on my way to becoming a concert classical guitar player. I wanted to be a professional musician, but my mother insisted that I get something practical under my belt. Learn how the world works, she said. So I did. I went to school. I studied business. And I eventually moved to San Francisco, where I was afforded the opportunity to play music at night, and I developed a career during the day. I was first hired by Avis Rent-A-Car, and then IBM. This was in the 70s, where I was promoted to a managerial position, and then became a management trainer and a sales trainer. And one story that sticks with me is with IBM. I was the only black person in this company, in this division, and I was out to dinner. I was a big brother. I used to take the kids, the black kids, out for skiing. We used to go to Lake Tahoe and go skiing. I took about 8 or 9 of them. And I was eating dinner with my boss, and I was just talking about it. I said, I'm going to take my kids to skiing. He says, you ski? I said, yeah, I ski. And these kids are white, right? No, they're all black. They ski too? I said, yeah, they all ski. I said, I taught them to ski. We made sure they learned how to ski. Wow. I said, well, I guess that's a good thing, because if you guys ever get lost, they won't ever have a problem finding you. That's the reaction I want to hear. It was a shock to me. It was the first time, actually, that I can remember. It stuck with me because I was never trained or conditioned to see myself as being able to do not being able to do anything that anyone else could do. But in that moment, when I heard that joke, I realized, oh, it wasn't that he said it. He said it out loud. He said it publicly. He said it amongst other people. And he actually expected me to laugh with him because he believed that I was colluding with that same sense of degradation and oppression and racism that he had. And it told me something, because when I looked at some of the other black people who heard that joke, they laughed with him. And I didn't. And I got in trouble for not laughing. He said, oh, you don't think that's funny, huh? No, I didn't think that was funny. And I learned later that I got a lot of promotions were passed by me because of that. So, yeah. So anyway, I worked with IBM, and I took those kids skiing. And I took them skiing for 4 years, and we had a lot of great skiers, black skiers, some who went on to, who are still skiing today, who I hear from. I don't ski anymore, but they do. Then I got into acting. Perhaps I can tell you that story at another time, because it's a convoluted story. But needless to say, I started late. But theater, acting, and music, it stayed with me throughout my life, and I'm grateful for that. But I also developed an aptitude as an organizational development consulting. And then this thing called sensitivity training. I don't know if you remember that, if you had a job, you know, remember sensitivity training? Yeah. Which later became, you may not know, diversity training, which popped up in mainstream corporate training. Organizations were getting sued for, what, sexual harassment. That's where it all came from. It was you ladies that were finally saying, hey, you know what, enough already. You know, we're tired of being treated down, talked down to. We're tired of this condescending. We're tired of, and it wasn't even about equal rights. It wasn't about equal pay. It was about being harassed, sexually harassed. Because at that time, men thought they could do that. I mean, obviously they still do. Which is shocking, I have to say, but I'm not going to go there. But anyway, organizations were getting sued by, like, I mean, big companies were getting sued like crazy for sexual harassment. And so as a corporate trainer, it was easy for me to slip into the role of the diversity trainer. And then one year, in the early 90s, I was asked to develop a training for the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, which is ACT. Big schools where Denzel went and a bunch of people. Because the problem was is that white directors were having a problem directing artists of color. And I had a theory back then that black actors, when they're working in mainstream classical work and typically being asked to play a white role with a white director, that they're actually colluding with a sense of piece of their own self-hatred and self-oppression, because you're playing a white role, you're also being directed by a white director, and you go into every experience as an African-American man and woman trying to please. And in so pleasing, you, what do? You shut yourself off. You disconnect from yourself. You disconnect from your own sense of self, your own, the no in you, because as an actor, you got to find that no. If you're always saying yes, you can't find, and the Tevin, who I've worked with, he's great at no. No, I ain't going to do that. That don't work for me. And that's what you want. That's what you want. But ACT was having a problem because all the actors were saying yes. So I put a course together that helped them find their internalized oppression, how their own self-hatred, and find a way to work with that, you know. Start there as a performer. If, whatever role you're going to play, start from where you are. And someone came over to me and said, you know, it's very interesting the way you work. There's a guy in Portland. His name is Arnold Mandel. You should go work with him. He's at the Process Work Institute. And I didn't know anything about the Process Work Institute, but I came up and took a look at it, and process work was different. It was very, very cool. I mean, it looks at things that trouble you, and rather than seeing it as bad or wrong, it sees it as the potential seed for growth and evolution. So if there's something inside of you, whether it's an illness or a problem in a relationship or a problem in a job or it's a body symptom, rather than just trying to make it go away, it actually encourages you to unfold it, to go deeper, to explore it, to embrace it. Because in that, there's learning. And sometimes what feels like it shouldn't be here, it's like in an organization, you know. Even here, someone in the room was to get unruly and start saying crazy stuff. Well, an inclination might be to say, okay, you, out of here. Not that you guys would do that, I can tell you. But in most cases, many cases, people do that, right? But what another option would be, sir, come on up front. Tell us what you got going on here. Talk to us. What's going on in your mind right now? What are you feeling? What are you thinking? Now, there may be nothing there, but there may be a whole lot there. And just the experience itself can actually unfold a lot of learning. So that was a great thing for me. I loved it. So after that, I said, yeah, I want to do this. So they have this conference in Washington, D.C. It's an international process work conference called World Work. 300 people from all over the world come there, and they work on world issues, oppressions and sexism and racism and classism. And what really interested me was the caste system out of India. That was shocking to me. I've read about it, and you know, but I'm meeting people who have from that system where they've been constrained. And no matter how smart you are, and how much you know, or how much you want to be different, or how hard you want to work to further your life, you're stuck, man. You are in that caste system for a lot of folks. And that helped me see something about my own experience as an African American. Yeah, I'm catching a little hell here. But I do think I have a way out, whereas there wasn't so much that. So that changed my life in a lot of ways, and that actually helped me on my journey. World Work is where I met my wife, who is Jewish. She's a Jewish woman who was raised as a communist, believe it or not. She's a therapist, and she was my teacher in process work. And I really bonded with her. She taught me a lot about process work. She taught me the model. And in that model is a wonderful way to work with conflict and painful situations and issues. A way that rather than feeling like I have to polarize from it, I can step into it. That I don't have to assign the meaning that I've been assigning when someone's angry at me. I don't have to make it about me. But I can see what's going on over there, and I can step more into it. It was wonderful. And then I began to study systems theory. Oh, Lord, I studied systems theory. That's just, whew. Systems theory is based on the idea that everything is a system, and as such, it is comprised of parts of a collection of components and elements that are organized and surrounded by a boundary. So this is a system. This is a system. That's a system. I'm a system. Everyone here is a system. Collectively, as a group of people, we are systems. One system, the system of church. What you do here is different than what you do when you are in the system of theater or movies or shopping. And so it is a system. And then I started to think, ideas are systems. Everything is a system. Fascinating stuff. And all systems, I realize, do three things. They protect each other, they protect themselves, they expand, and they evolve. So this boundary, this thing has to protect itself. If it doesn't, then it will become something else. So if it needs to expand, it will only be if it gets hot, it will burn. It will turn into fire, right? It will evolve, it will turn into ashes. Now, we might have a feeling about that. We might, oh, that's so sad, the poor wood turned into ashes. But the wood doesn't know that. And that led me to cultures. I'm getting somewhere with this, y'all. Cultures are systems. Every culture protects itself. It expands, and hopefully it evolves. Every culture has parts that are organized to keep certain things in and certain other things out. We need cultures. It's what organizes us to get stuff done. What are those things that every culture has? Well, every culture has ideals. It has a prescription about how we should behave. What's the right way? What should we aspire to do and be? It has values. What is important to me? It has beliefs. What is true for me? It has attitudes. What's the state that I should be in when I'm doing what I'm doing? And then it has behaviors. What should I do? Every culture does that. And so then I looked at Oregon. And I looked at its history. Who knows Oregon's history? A little bit. Who knows Oregon's history but just doesn't want to say they know Oregon's history? So I'm not going to give you a history class, but there's a wonderful course that an African-American woman, her name is Walida Almarisha, is a good friend of mine. She teaches a course on what happened to all the black people in Oregon. It's a great course because there's a very systematic reason why there aren't so many black folks in Oregon versus Washington, where there's a whole bunch more black folks. So there's a culture here. So what happened, you know, post-slavery was, you know, we would say that Oregon was anti-slavery. But no, they weren't really anti-slavery. They were anti-black. You see the difference? And what Oregon decided to do is to extricate itself from the whole mess by saying, you know what, we just don't want to deal with that slavery thing. You know, and the way we're going to not deal with that slavery thing is we're just not going to deal with black people. So it was illegal to be black in Oregon. And that there was a time that if you were found in Oregon, you could be picked up and taken out. Or, Tevin, do you remember what the rule was? Two times a year. If you were found in Oregon as a black person, you could be whipped two times a year and then sent out on your birthday. And that's in the books. That's in the books. I'm not making that up. So when I think about culture, okay, I think about, well, so we got ideals, we got values, we got beliefs and attitudes and behaviors that create what? A white utopia. Okay? Now, that's just something that needs to be paid attention to. And what we have been doing as a culture is ignoring this universal truth. A system can only do what it is organized to do. That I'm saying that from what I've learned about systems. Now, that's not me speaking up here as the minister saying the truth, because I don't do that. But systems can only do what they're organized to do. This cannot be a chair. It cannot be a glass of water. I cannot be a billy goat. I am organized to be who I am. And so as I think about that, I think about racism. And this way of thinking gave me a new lens to examine and understand racism. It gave me the door out of the emotional angst and painful stories that I was raised on that created a whole construct around racism that was filled with anger and self-righteousness and repulsion. And is he leaving because of something I said? Okay. Is it okay, great. Okay. Gotta ask. So it gave me a door. And I realized that racism is a system that is organized to do something very specific, to protect the culture. Now we have to say that is bad. We can say that's bad or evil or whatever, but I don't see it like that. I used to, but I don't ascribe intent to racism. I see it as a system that does stuff. If I think of it as a system trying to protect itself, it gives me more room to breathe, and I can get a lot more done. And I don't have to fight, because I've been to jail fighting against racism. And I've been in a lot of fights. And I've been in a lot of conflicts that have gotten nowhere. And I've lost a lot of friends in my life, a lot of dear friends who just weren't ready to have me beat them upside the head for days, telling them how wrong they were for thinking the way they were thinking. So to change the system, a couple of things have to happen. It's environment. The environment has to change, and that's where Hands Up comes in. I'll talk about that. When it gets cold, we put on a coat. When the wood gets too hot, it burns, which changes its function or its purpose. And to change its function, the relationship within the system changes. then when that changes, then the communication changes within the system. So as things start to change in this system, in this white system, in this Oregon system, we talk differently. We say different things. And interestingly enough, we start talking to different people, people that we don't normally talk to. So enter the August Wilson Red Door Project. Where did that come from? Why August Wilson? August Wilson was an anthropologist. A lot of people don't realize that because he never studied it, right? He left school at 15 years old. But if you study him, read his work, you'll see that that's what he did. He was studying how people and why people do what they do. He wasn't always ready to judge people and say they're wrong. He was trying to understand why and how people get stuff done. So that's why I recommend seeing How I Learn What I Learn. He studied culture, not just African-American culture, but American culture in general. And he transferred that learning through art, poetry, and his plays. 10 plays depicting the African-American culture, one decade at a time, starting with 1900s to the 1990s. Why the Red Door? Why August Wilson Red Door? It's a symbol of transformation. Red Door was where Aunt Esther, if anybody is familiar with his plays, she's a significant character from his plays, lived in Pittsburgh. And as the story went, before the newly freed slaves go forth and live their life, they must first visit Aunt Esther, who would take you on a mystical journey to the City of Bones, which is deep in the ocean, the Middle Passage, where you would pay homage, where a slave would pay homage, because you couldn't move, you couldn't grow, you couldn't go forth and live your life until you paid homage to the people who died before you. And in that, there's a sense of redemption. You release your self-hatred, your self-oppression, and you go forth. And that's why we call it the Red Door, because we're not only offering that to African-Americans, but we offer that to all of us, white and black, is that in order to heal this whole idea of racism, we have to first go within. There's healing that we all have to do individually. I can't heal your pain. You can't heal my pain. But working together and talking together and listening together can be a very healing experience. And our mission is to change the racial ecology of Portland through the arts. It's a catchy phrase, but ecology is actually a fitting term. A garden needs many elements to thrive. It needs air, it needs water, it needs bees, bugs. We had one high school kid who said, dead animals. I said, right, fertilizer. And in the same way, if you take any of those elements away, it no longer thrives. It may even die. And just like a garden, our community needs to stay in balance. Portland is like a garden. To ensure a healthy ecology, all the voices must be heard. If some voices are left out, ignored, marginalized, put to the side, then the garden doesn't flourish, change, expand so that it's able to adapt to the environment in a healthy way. And that's what we got going on here in Portland. There are people and communities who are not being heard. We've had some goals. One of our goals was to encourage theaters to present more work by, for, and with, and around people of color. The problem was, when we worked with theaters to do this, the problem was theaters didn't know how to engage. They were afraid, and so they demanded that Portland people of color adapt to their way of doing things. So we created a diversity training, a consortium called PEACE, P-E-A-C, Portland Equity for the Arts Consortium. We worked with theaters for 6 months, 3 hours a month, training them, funders too, focusing on how to create a welcoming environment. The main idea is how do you deal with difference, right? I have to say, you guys do a really good job of that. I'm impressed. I mean, you do the church thing, I get it, but when I look on the walls, you know, I don't see, you know, those monuments, those white classical monuments from the past that scare me to death. It's nice. And what I see is a place where you create a room that looks like you anticipated me being at the table. And that's what we try to do with people, is to give them a room, to teach them how to create a room where you anticipate me being at the table. Someone who's different. It makes a big difference. So we created PEAK. We then decided that we wanted to sponsor the August Wilson Monologue Competition. We decided that we wanted to join the national movement to get the August Wilson, August Wilson's work in our school system. So we work with 100 students. We put them in. We work with the teachers. We work with the students. We do that because you know what? White teachers are afraid of black students. They're afraid of them because they're different. Difference breeds contempt. And so what we did was we gave the teachers a curriculum so that they could start to talk about African American culture, talk about African American vernacular, talk about things that are African American in a way that gives the students a sense of safety. Oh, you know about me. You know about my life. You know about my history. You know about me. Okay, cool. And then that creates a bond. We're starting to see that in a big way in the high schools now. Teachers, white teachers, are not moving away from black students in the way that they have in the past. Why do we do this? 58% of all high school students graduate high school. 85% of all, 58% of black students graduate from high school. 85% of white students graduate from high school. And the number's kind of going down for black students. So we got a lot of work to do. And so this brings us to Hands Up. Why did we choose to do Hands Up? Because Hands Up merged together two very important elements for change. The environment was changing. People were becoming educated. The white mainstream culture was becoming outraged. The use of simple the use of a simple piece of technology created a cultural disruption. We could now see what was happening, and that offered us an opportunity to change the conversation. It opened the door for different kinds of relationships, and as human beings, we all have a natural instinct to care for other human beings when we feel it's safe. And it is an evolutionary imperative also. It is how we protect ourselves. It's by talking. We don't know that. We don't think about it. That's simple. So the world was changing. We have more people of color in the world, and we're having different kinds of relationships with each other, a different conversation, which means we can affect change in our culture in a way that we have never been able to before, and that's why we want to present Hands Up across the state for the next 2 years. A lot of people don't know that. So right now, we started with 25 people in a room, and today we fill a room with 400 in about 24 hours. When I say fill a room, I mean that the tickets are sold within 24 hours. People bring their families, their coworkers. Some people come 10 times. We're partnering with some of the major stakeholders in the city of Portland, the public school system, the Portland State University, Portland Community College, Northwest Philanthropy, Portland 5 downtown. And we just had a meeting 2 days ago with the Portland Police, our fourth meeting, and who are working with us. And we will be presenting a closed show for the Portland Police Academy on November 14th. Hands Up is a compilation of 7 monologues that were written by 7 playwrights, 7 African-American playwrights, depicting the African-American experience for them that was inspired after the Ferguson event. Kevin is going to perform one of them today, one of the most powerful ones. These words are riveting, and they speak not only to the white mainstream culture, which we're constantly hearing, I didn't know that this was going on, but also to the African-American community who is saying, finally, my experience. I mean, I've been harassed since I was 18 years old by the police, and I still get harassed. It's part of my life. It's something that I accept, and it's also a lot of shame for me. It's something that I don't really like to talk about because I always feel like, oh, maybe I did something wrong. But when I saw that show for the first time and I read those scripts, I thought, whoa. It's kind of like if you've seen Saving Private Ryan. Have you seen Saving Private Ryan? Do you remember all of the older World War II veterans who came out, who broke out in tears and said, have talked, actually shared their experiences for the first time because they felt like they got it. They understand. And that's a healing thing. And that was what was happening for African-American kids. So systems thinking works. Yes, Oregon was a white utopia, but all systems can change. You just got to know where to hit. So art I like to call it art, a linguistic component of culture that reflects back to us who we are through language and symbols. When I got here, when I was I saw a white, liberal, middle-class culture being reflected back to me, I told myself something was wrong here and it had to be changed. And as an artist, I feel a responsibility to be a cultivator of evolution. and in so doing to question long-term beliefs, to stay a learner as it relates to these issues, to never forget that even though race and other forms of separation is a contrived construct, it's still very much a viable mechanism that impacts all of us, both positively and negatively, of course. And it is the job of not only the artist, but also the consumer of art to always challenge us, and in so doing, to challenge our fellow humans to see and feel the human family and all its so-called appearances. So finally, I want to proclaim my desire to be challenged as an artist and as a social commentator to step out of pop culture's narrative about race. That narrative being that there are bad people and there are good people in this world, and that the good people are getting hurt and it's the bad people who are doing the hurting. I don't buy that. This notion sets the stage for simplistic kinds of stories, and personally, I'm bored with those stories. They're not integral to how we live our lives today, nor are they socially responsible in their lack of complexity. The victim-oppressor discourse forces us to stay on the sidelines. It doesn't speak to us personally, and it's not the kind of relationship that describes what we're reaching for in our lives today or in our future. It's time for us to create new stories. Thank you.